This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
It's my pleasure to introduce our speaker tonight. So Dr. Breiman is a colleague and a friend. He is one of our fantastic educators here at UCSF. He's a clinical professor of radiology. In the Department of Radiology and Biomedical Imaging here. He is actually now retired from teaching and work, which really makes us sad, but they called him back because they really couldn't function without him. I interacted with him because he was in the Academy of Medical Educators here, recognized as one of our outstanding medical educators, and also he was the director of the Henry Goldberg Center for Advanced Imaging, which is just a fantastic ultra-modern center to teach our medical students and residents how to interpret radiographic imaging. So his research interests include applications of 3D image processing of CT and MR scans for diagnosis, surgical guidance, and education. He's authored or co-authored over 50 scientific journals and articles. He obtained his medical degree from UCSF. He trained in surgery at Yale, orthopedics at University of California, San Diego. Then he switched into radiology. You can see he's a man of all trades. Actually, in his residency at Stanford in radiology, he helped to develop CT imaging technology. And he was on the faculty at Duke University. He was in private practice for a while, and then he joined us at UCSF. So we're fortunate to have Dr. Breiman, who's going to talk to us about being a medical detective with radiologic imaging.
Thank you, Jeff. Well, I hope you have some fun and you learn something with this. We really are medical detectives. We have these great tools. Much like Sherlock, we have a real bag of tools, which we'll go over many of them, but in the space of this time constraint, we can't go over them all. But everything we do is detective work. Even normal exams, we're looking for some answer, and that is an answer when it turns out to be normal. So I will go over a little bit about the role of radiology in patient care, the history, where did it all start, and where did it go through the years, and what imaging tools we have. Like this is a 3D of a CT scan. It's just a conventional head scan that I've converted into a 3D rendering to give more information and more perspective than you can get out of the original CT. We'll go through some of the, you know, the detective method that we use to solve medical mysteries. And I'll show you some illustrative cases. And then, unfortunately, I don't have time for some of the non-medical applications, which I think are pretty good and pretty interesting to me, but we won't be able to do that, but we'll leave time for discussion. So basically, a radiologist doesn't just sit in front of view boxes in the past or a computer monitor now. We're also involved in quality assurance for radiology exams. We're involved in designing individual studies. Somebody comes in for a CT scan. We design the protocol, or an MR scan, or any high-tech type of imaging modality. We are designing the protocol to answer their specific question. So everyone is not exactly the same. And then we also monitor them. So if a CT scan is done, or an MR scan, or an ultrasound, the radiologist is actually looking at the images before the patient leaves to make sure that all the questions that we can possibly answer are answered, and if any new questions come up because of what we see on the initial images, we might modify and get some additional images. So we're involved in that as well. And we're consultants to virtually every medical specialty. So not only do we issue a dictated report, which they can have access to anywhere that the patient is being seen, but I also pick up the phone, or they call me, and we discuss the findings and correlate the findings with the medical issues that are going on at the time. So we really are a consultant, a part of the team that is trying to determine what the medical problem is and how to solve it. And then in recent years, maybe the last 15, 20 years, interventional radiology has developed, which is using tools, hardware, to get answers without having to open the patient to get a biopsy. We can do it with a needle percutaneously, using imaging to guide, and I'll talk about this in more detail, to avoid the structures we don't want to hit with that needle or probe or whatever we're putting in, or catheter, and getting right to the area of concern in the safest way possible without having to open the patient. Or we can even treat patients' problems, whether they be tumors or bleeds or whatever. So we'll talk about that in some detail. This is just a list of the subspecialties within radiology. And as you can see, we do end up being involved in every part of the body in some way. And here at UCSF, we have specialists in neuroradiology or thoracic imaging or abdominal imaging, which is mainly what I am, or bone radiology, et cetera. So, you know, we can subspecialize, or people can be general radiologists and do a lot of things. And then, as I mentioned, these other applications of the same tools that we use in medical imaging could be used to image mummies to find out what happened to them, you know, what's inside, what diseases do they have, et cetera, and even prehistoric creatures. So where have we been and where are we going? It started in 1895. When Rentgen discovered the X-ray, and I'll show you some images of him, and he got the Nobel Prize in 1901. The first Nobel Prize in physics went to Rentgen for his discovery of the new ray, the X-ray. The next 75 years were pretty much modifying that technique. Better film, better ways to process the film. But it was still film, and it was still an X-ray. But we had ways to opacify structures, whether they be vessels or other organs, et cetera. And it wasn't until 1971 that we really got into the computer age of radiology, and that was when Godfrey Hounsfield invented the CT scanner. And that's actually the reason I took this path through surgery and then switched to radiology. It was put out in 1973 as the first head scanner, and that's the year I graduated from UCSF. And I was already committed to orthopedic surgery. I loved it, but I was so excited by the technology and the future that I switched to radiology for that reason. So I can thank him for that. And it was a good decision, too. I mean, I loved patient care, and I loved being in surgery, but I love radiology as well. And from then on, the computer really had a lot to do with all the tools that we use today. Ultrasound, MR scanning, magnetic resonance. And then we got computer-based systems to view the images, to manipulate them, to transmit them. And nuclear medicine has been around for a long time, but some very modern exams like PET CT scans, which I'll talk about a little bit at the end. So here's Rentgen. And, you know, he was a German physicist at the University of Würzburg in central Germany. And he was using one night, it was dark, he was using what's called a Crookes tube, a cathode ray tube. And it's a glass tube. You put in voltage. It creates a beam of electrons. They hit another part, and you can redirect it. And it wasn't used for this purpose, but he was using a higher dose, a higher voltage one night, and he noticed across the room he had a phosphorescent plate, and all of a sudden it started to light up. And he said, whoa, what is that? And he put something in front of the tube, and it still lit up. So it wasn't something like some light that he wasn't seeing. It went right through the object he put in front of it, and still that plate phosphoresced. So he knew he was onto something new. But he didn't know what it was. So he spent the next 6 weeks in his lab. He virtually slept. He ate there. His wife was wondering what he's really doing there. And eventually, he brought her there. And that's Mrs. Rentgen. And he took the very first X-ray of her hand. That's her wedding ring. and you know the joints of her hand. It's not the it's not a sharp image on today's standard, but that was the very first X-ray ever taken. I made a pilgrimage to his lab in Würzburg in 2008. So for me, it was the holy grail to be there. It's a very small lab, much smaller than this room, half the size of this room, where he had all sorts of equipment. And these are some of the cathode ray tubes that I was telling you about. There are these glass tubes that have some of the gas evacuated, and then the electron beam goes through. And here I am in his lecture hall. And it was a thrill for me. And my son accompanied me. I don't know if it was a big thrill for him, but he could tell my enthusiasm. And after 1895, that's when he invented it, and he published it in December of 1895. I just recently, last month, one of his initial manuscripts was at auction, and I got to hold it in my hands at Bonhams in San Francisco. But very rapidly, this caught on. And this is the very first U.S. X-ray lab at Dartmouth in 1896. Edison thought, hey, this could be a great light bulb. It did, because it does emit light. Not the greatest thing in terms of, it has some downsides in terms of the commercial value as a light bulb, but he didn't know that at the time. That's Edison. And then there were these studios that would crop up to X-ray people's hands and things. And then it became, X-ray was like saying high-tech or space age, in the last, back in the early days of the space age, or putting an eye in the front of the name of your phone. X-ray was the thing in terms of a buzzword. There was, every sort of thing in advertising. They even wrote music about it. But we still, all through the years, as I said, there were developments, better films, better ways to develop films. Initially, this is the way they were developed. They were hung on a line, maybe not outside, but inside, and a wet reed or a stat reed, it was still wet. The doctor would come and say, well, what did it show? And it's dripping wet, but you show them, and they called that a wet reed. You could take them anywhere. There was a light source, so you could do a curbside consult out in the light. And then when we got imaging that had more and more images associated with them, we needed some way to display them. This is before there were computer workstations. So, they were filmed on little images on big films, and we had view boxes all over the place to compare. Let me show you. I'll show you in a minute some of the chaos that we went through in those days. And we had very little in the way of detective tools. We could magnify an image. We could hold it in front of a bright light. If it was a dark part of it, we could see a little bit more information in front of a bright light. If it was a white area on the film, you couldn't bring any more information out of that. We could compare images, but let me tell you, it was chaos. There would be films in the wrong jackets. Because we only had films. So if they were misfiled, you spent an enormous amount of time trying to get like a CT scan with 25 films and maybe hundreds of images sorted out from the other one and several other imaging files. So it took a lot of time to work through all this. We had these film developers that had to be processed with chemicals. We had to store in beacons and other storage places because we didn't have the room for all the images. It was just a mess. And then part of the development was it all became digital. So in the last 13 years here and more, haven't seen a single film unless somebody brings it in for me to look at. We even have ways if somebody brings in a film, we can digitize it and make it available for comparison to the digital images that we have. So a chest X-ray is all digital. Everything is on a computer. And we'll talk about that. So here is Godfrey Hounsfield with the first head scanner. It was only big enough hole for a head. That was the first was introduced in 1973. And what it did, though, is just so revolutionary. Not only was it computer-based, but it was cross-sectional. So we could eliminate the effect of overlying densities on something that wasn't as dense. So bones in front of something like lung would obscure what was in the lung. Now that it's cross-sectional, we eliminate that problem. We can get And then we have a volume of data which we can repackage in any way we want to get a better anatomic perspective on what's going on in terms of the anatomic relationships between normal and abnormal tissues, for instance. And it uses detectors instead of film, which are more sensitive to various properties of the tissues. And as I mentioned, it's all digital. And I'm going to go through the radiology detectives' tools, CT being one of them, but X-ray is still one of them also. Ultrasound, MR, nuclear medicine, PET CT, et cetera, are all our tools and our bag of tricks. And then PACS is the name for the computer-based workstation and the whole process of manipulating, storing, archiving, transmitting the data. It's called Picture Archiving Communication System, or PACS. And then, as I said, we have the computer workstations, and we even dictate now with voice recognition. So in the past, for much of my career, we would dictate. Somebody would type it. It would take time. We'd have to correct the typos. And in some places where they didn't have enough transcriptionists, it could take a week, literally, or more, to get a report out to the clinician. Not a timely thing for somebody trying to make a timely decision about management of a patient's problem when they don't get the report for a week or two. I dictate. I see it on a screen. I'll show you this in a minute. And the report goes right out, and it can be viewed anywhere. And we can also look at images anywhere. We can transmit them instead of just seeing them where the film library is and come in and look at a film. We can take those images and send them to the operating room, send them to the clinic, send them to another facility. You know, here at UCSF, we're all over the city, but it doesn't matter. It's like we're all in one place. I can read from one facility for, images from any other facility. The emergency department here at on Parnassus, the outpatient facilities here on Parnassus, the inpatients, while reading also Mount Zion inpatients and outpatients, or from Mission Bay. And I do that every day. So it's an unbelievable step. And then we can also, of course, give you CDs. You can take them to some other institution. They can put it into their system and compare it to a study being done at their institution side by side, as if it was done in their institution, and vice versa. You can bring us CDs. So it's really a remarkable change. But this is the way X-ray works. So we have, you know, in this case, the detector is a film. And in the case, I'll show you what detectors are in other modalities. So the X-ray beam goes through the patient, and various tissues block the X-ray, some more than others. So bone would block a lot of X-rays and be white on the image, and air wouldn't block very much X-rays at all and be black, and everything in between. And that's how an X-ray worked. But, you know, the film is the detector. And here, for instance, is an X-ray. The bones blocked a lot of the X-rays, so they're white. The air up here at the top in the lungs is black. Air in the stomach is black. And then we can see other things because there's fat, which is also low density and doesn't block much X-ray. It blocks more than air does. We can see outlines of structures because there's fat next to it. So, for instance, there are the outlines of various organs. The medical detective, the radiologist, has to know what the anatomy is and be able to pick these things out from an image. And, of course, if there's a kidney stone, it'll be darker. It'll be whiter because it blocks more X-ray. Okay, so here we get to the CT scanner. And that's a mummy, but, you know, patient, mummy, they're all the same, except that one's not alive. And the X-ray tube is on one side, and it puts out a fan beam of X-rays, and the detectors are on the other side. And there initially were maybe 15, 20, up to 100 detectors. Now there are hundreds of detectors in a modern-day CT scanner. And every pulse of the X-ray beam is detected by each one of these little detectors. Now they're very small. And it determines how much X-ray was absorbed by the patient and how much got through to the detector. But because there are so many detectors and they're scanning from all around the patient, we have all this mass of data. Now we can go back and figure out for a cube of the patient how much X-ray was absorbed, because they do mathematical projections from all around the patient, and then you can go back and it's called back projection, and figure out how much X-ray was absorbed by that cube of tissue and that cube of tissue, et cetera. And so we have a volume of data. And it's all just data. It's computer data at that point. And at that point, we convert it into an image by assigning arbitrarily an amount of darker gray or white based on how much X-ray was absorbed and how much... And arbitrarily, water was picked as zero on this scale. So it has a certain look when we reconstruct an image. And everything denser than water is a little lighter gray or white, and everything less dense than water is darker, like fat. And they're assigned what are called CT numbers, or HU, for Godfrey Hounsfield. Hounsfield units is what they're called. And we can look on the image and actually get a number. Any place on a patient's scan, we can see what that number is. But that's how the image is reconstructed. So here I've just shown you an image where I put a bunch of these region of interest on here to show you different degrees of density or Hounsfield units. So this isn't exactly water because it's never exactly zero, but that's the stomach with fluid in it, and it has a Hounsfield unit, I believe, is about 10.7, and the liver will be about 125. Fat, let me see if I marked fat. I did. Over here, fat is minus 70. So you get the idea. And this is actually, these are vessels. This is in the liver, the portal vein in the liver. This is the abdominal aorta. And it's white because we injected intravenous contrast in an attempt to opacify those vessels and the organs supplied by those vessels. So they're white. 30 seconds later, they won't be as white because it'll be washed out and diluted. So we take advantage of that sort of thing too, which I'll talk a little bit about later. And CT scanners had a big degree of progression, a lot of technological development in CT from the time of the first CT scanner. This was a head scan back in 1973, and they became better and better, thinner and thinner slices, faster image gathering, and more images, which became, it becomes very cumbersome to go through all the images one by one, which is what we do, but also to get a three-dimensional appreciation for the anatomic relationships can be difficult for some people. Some people think really well in 3D, and they build the image in their mind, and they can figure out the relationships. Some people don't, and people are just born that way. So, and here's an example of a CT scan with 2,300 images as part of the scan. From the, up from the neck to the toes, it was part of a CT angiogram where we're actually looking at the vessels. So what do? We can also, take all that volume of data and we can repackage it so it's easier to understand. This is a very simple way to do it, multiplanar reformation. We wouldn't look at three different planes at the same time. I'm just showing you this for display purposes, but we would look at one of those. So we take the axial transverse images, and we look at them in some other plane, oblique, coronal, sagittal, et cetera. Or we can take them and make a true 3D rendering out of that data, much like an animated film would be made, using the same techniques, essentially, for from Pixar or Lucasfilm, et cetera, to make an animated film. This is the exact same block of data, and nothing's done except we're manipulating the data with volume rendering. And we have lots of things. This isn't only an incomplete list of all the things we can adjust with that software. We can cut out parts of the patient, look inside. This is not a photograph. This is the actual just cross-sectional grayscale images that have been reconstructed, reformatted into a 3D. And then we can, this is the exact same data, we just manipulated it a little differently. It takes milliseconds to do that. So it's very powerful. We can introduce motion so that although you're looking at a 2D screen, you can get a better appreciation for the 3D relationships because it's moving and you can see it from different angles. And we can introduce motion. true motion, like cardiac beating. When I was at Stanford and I worked with the Varian Corporation on the development of one of the first body scanners, we invented this technique of EKG gating. Patient has an EKG on during the scan. We know exactly where the data came in their cardiac cycle, and we can repackage it in a different way to get this kind of an image. So this is true beating. This is not simulated. This is the patient's own cardiac activity. Now, to give you a feeling for how powerful this is, I'm going to give you a little demonstration of something non-medical. On a Saturday on call here at UCSF, I had a break, and I took a bunch of things to the CT scanner and scanned them. And they were things like toys for my kids' room, and I had a fossil I scanned and things like that. These are different ones. And let me just take you through and see if you can guess what these objects are, because that's what we're doing with CT. These are just grayscale axial images. These are the source images, like a brain scan. Do you have any idea what this might be?
Like a theater.
Like a what?
Like a theater, like curtains.
Oh, it does, actually. But no, it's actually something before we had flash drives, et cetera, used to archive for your computer. It's a stack of CDs or DVDs. And that's the spindle in the middle. It's pretty dense, real dense. I'll give you a hint. That's a belt clip. It's a cell phone. It was one of the early ones. At that time I had a Trio. Now, of course, I've had multiple iPhones, et cetera. But that's a Trio. It's a smartphone. Now, if you're a medical student studying anatomy, and this came right out of the Goldberg Center's lab where I taught medical students anatomy. I'm actually a professor of anatomy, too, by the way. You probably don't know what this is, and I'm going to show you how easy it is to figure it out in a second. This was a living structure right before I brought it to the lab. It's a flower, and I picked it. It was outside my window, and I thought, that'd be an interesting one to scan. So I brought a flower over there. And you'll never guess this one, I presume, unless you've seen my bookshelf. Okay, so let me show you what these things really are. I mean, how easy it is. Here's the 3D. In no time at all, you can tell what these things are. That was a heart, a model of a heart. There's the flower. And that was a bobblehead radiologist, which I have on my shelf in my office. Here's the flower. I mean, we can do all things. That's the same grayscale. This is the data that you just saw. We can do things like this. We can make a movie out of it and make it look like it's aging. But it's all from that grayscale data. Well, it's the same thing we do with patients. It gives us a better appreciation for what's going on. Here's the abdomen of a patient, where you can see the liver, the kidneys, the spine, the ribs, and get a feeling for their relationships. Very complex anatomy in you and I. These are just vessels in the abdomen. And it's a tangle of information. But we can better display it so a surgeon or whoever can understand the relationships of those structures. And I think it does increase our ability to recognize and perceive subtle abnormalities, even above their source images. They're all on the source images. But we can better appreciate them when we see them in 3D. And so I'm just giving you the tools of a radiology detective. We'll get into some cases and demonstrate this for you in a little bit. And we can, as I said, more efficiently go through large data sets. I'll demonstrate this in a few minutes as well. And it's better communication of results to the clinicians, which means they may be able to use the results better to make better management decisions and have a better outcome with the patient's problem. And it's easier to demonstrate it to the patient. You know, what's going to happen to me? What are they going to operate on? What organs are you going to have to deal with, and what's in the way? So it's a lot easier to communicate. Here's an example. On an X-ray, we would see, this is a fracture of the pelvis, complex fracture, and of the acetabulum, which is where the femoral head, the ball, goes into the cup. And this patient had a complex pelvic fracture. You can see it on X-ray, or most of the components you can see on an X-ray. You can see it on the CT. But when you do a 3D like this, the surgeon or the orthopedic surgeon gets a lot more information. We can even virtually take out the femur and show just the cup, the acetabulum, and the complexity of the femur. We didn't do, we didn't take it off out of the patient. We just took it out of the image. Now, here's a virtual colonoscopy. We have 1,000 images for a CT for the virtual colonoscopy. And there are some little polyps. I don't know if there's a stronger... can you see this?
Yes.
Okay, again, okay, I'm having trouble. That's a tiny, about a 3-millimeter polyp in this colon. And here's just a short little clip of a travel through the colon and then back to a 6-millimeter polyp. That's only 6 millimeters. And we can tell exactly where it is in this model of the colon. This was created from the patient. So this is the patient's actual, recreation of the path that we go through. And we know exactly where it is. We can tell the gastroenterologist exactly where that polyp or mass or whatever it is we found is. You can also simulate using this technique. So a surgeon can determine what kind of procedure they're going to do and what the approach is going to be, maybe even practice it on a simulator before the surgery, and perhaps reduce complications because they know exactly where everything is, the normal structures, the abnormal structures, et cetera. And we now guide intraoperatively surgery based on preoperative 3D images, image guidance, and with instruments that have almost like GPS in them, where we know in space where they are relative to the patient's anatomy, because there's registration between the patient's anatomy and that preoperative 3D or whatever imaging it was used and the instrument itself. So it cuts down on complications, makes it more precise, particularly helpful in neurosurgery, et cetera. And we can even have remote guidance of surgical procedures, maybe in a battlefield situation or some place away from a center for excellence where somebody, maybe not as much now, but in the future, will be able to control the actual robotic surgery because they're the expert at this using this kind of imaging. So here's a patient that came from Africa, actually, to UCSF to have this mass taken out. And it's a very complex relationship between the mass and her vessels. So she came here. Here's a movie of, let me just speed through this. But you can see some of the processing we can do here with the 3D image processing technique, the volume rendering. There's her mass, and it's wrapped around her carotid artery. Pretty difficult. And we can continue on and look at the mass from various perspectives and even go into her head. And I teach also with stereoscopic 3D glasses on, so I can make a stereoscopic 3D movie of this, which I have done, and I teach medical students sitting in a room like this with 3D glasses on, and they see it popping out of the screen. So that's the vascular anatomy inside her head.
What's the green?
The green. You're going to ask me green. You're going to ask a colorblind person green. which is the green? Oh.
The mass itself.
Oh, the mass itself. Well, the colors are actually reflective of those CT numbers or Hounsfield units. So, but we pick the colors. We try to make it realistic, but once we pick a color, everything else has a relationship color-wise to that area because it's based on real data. But in terms of what's green, I can't tell you. And here's just another look at it. Apple actually had made a piece on me on their website, and this was on that in that description of the 3D research that I've done with them. And here it is from another perspective. And then you can even do a virtual resection. You can practice and take the mass away before the surgeon ever does. Or the surgeon can practice and determine. So here's the carotid artery without the mass around it. And, of course, she did have a successful result. And here's that, you saw that patient at the start, just using as an illustration to peer into the patient. Well, this is that patient with an aneurysm that has bled. I can tell you red in this patient is blood. And here's a movie of this. Well, you already saw this movie, but let me just quickly go through this. And there's the aneurysm and the relationship to the other vessels. And the red on the white bone is, in fact, a bleed. And there's the aneurysm again. So, you know, how does the radiology detective work? You know, our method is to create and manipulate the data, the images, get as much information as we can from it, and search for any clues. And sometimes they're very, very subtle. So, we need to be good observers, and we need to know how to analyze the findings, both with our knowledge and our sort of deductive reasoning as to what those little clues might mean in that patient's clinical setting. And also, you know, we have to be communicators. Communicate our results so that they're most useful to the doctors taking care of the patient. The first thing is to gather the data. We're selecting the appropriate exam. As I mentioned at the start, we're modifying that exam to fit the individual patient's needs. We're monitoring it. We're adding things to it. And we're also consultants and triage agents, you might say, in that when somebody has a problem, we're trying to pick the least invasive thing, the least costly exam to get the information needed. You know, we're not trying to rush in and do the most expensive test, the one with the radiation, the most radiation. We try where possible to do the things that don't have risk and don't have as much cost. And then if we need to, we move on to something else. So we're the people trying to help design those diagnostic approaches to the patient's problem. And as I say, monitor and modify the exam as needed. And then we're reviewing the images, we're searching for the clues, and we're trying to put it all together with the patient's clinical findings, much as Sherlock would have done, where sometimes it is the most subtle finding that's the most important. Not always, but sometimes it is. And the person who can see that subtle finding and then put it together with the clinical problem and figure out the answer is a good detective. Okay, so we can also, as I say, we have to correlate our findings with the patient's presentation, where this is our analysis part, and assess the stability. How does it look compared to the old exam? Is it worse? Is it better? You know, so we're not just looking at one image in the vacuum. We're looking at multiple images, a chest X-ray and a CT and an old CT, et cetera. And we're then trying to determine the effect on the management right now and how urgent is it. If it's an urgent issue, I pick up the phone. I don't just report this in a dictation. I pick up the phone and I don't stop. I'm sometimes here. I've stayed an hour and a half after hours trying to find somebody to take the information on that patient if it's an urgent thing. Hopefully it doesn't take an hour and a half. But, it's our responsibility to make sure in urgent situations that the people who are going to treat the patient know what's going on, and they treat the patient right then, not a day later, et cetera. And are these exams, is the information adequate to make a diagnosis, or do we need more, as I've mentioned, for both diagnosis, or do we need to follow the patient? It's adequate now for a diagnosis, but do we need to know a month from now, 3 months from now, or whatever, you know, what's going on? So we maybe have to bring the patient back for another exam. And, of course, as I said, we dictate the report or we pick up a phone, and we're doing the things I just mentioned. And we may be having a discussion with the patient or at least preparing the clinician to have a discussion with the patient that they can understand. So here, I took this last week with my iPhone. This is the workstation I was working on last week and also yesterday and the day before, and it consists of two monitors that I can see images. I can put multiple images up there. I can put a new exam and an old exam. I can put different kinds of exams on those screens. I have a screen to actually dictate. So here's my dictation device. And I have a computer, my favorite kind, to search the internet. As Dr. Tabas and I were just discussing before the talk, we might be going on Wiki. We might be going on Wikipedia. We might be going on another kind of a medical website and doing some research. A little close-up of an abdominal X-ray, a CT scan, and this screen where I pick up the dictaphone and I see my words going across the screen. I edit them on the fly because it's not 100% accurate, but it's pretty darn accurate right now. When I first started using these 13 years ago, it was, 95% accurate, but boy, the 5% it was not accurate were horrible and embarrassing if you didn't catch the mistakes. Now it's pretty accurate. And then when I click the button to sign it off, it goes out to the clinicians right then. It's instantaneous. So often before the patient even leaves our area, the clinician has a report. Or I pick up that other device, which is still extremely important. I use that 20, 25 times a day. And I talk to the emergency department about, what are they, because I get this little information on the patient. And they expand the information for me. I tell them what our findings are, and we sort of talk about what they might mean in that patient. So here's a movie I made with my iPhone. I tried to hold it as still as I could. So here's a scan of a patient who has pain. And I'm going through, the images from her diaphragm. So this is an abdominal and pelvic CT. I'm going through, and I'm going to show you some of her findings. Anybody see any findings so far? I'll show you some still images. Maybe it'll be easier on that. And this is our toolbar. So, this is just a few of the tools. So, yes, Sherlock had his magnifying lens, and that's what we had before computers. But we have all sorts of tools, and this is only a partial. This is what my user preference. I put this on this toolbar, but there are about 100 other ones I could put on there. These are the ones I use most, and I'll show you how we use them. We can change the window settings. So unlike, as I mentioned before, with a film where you could bright light a dark area, I can do whatever I want with these. It's all this digital data, computer data. So that was looking at the lung windows, as we call them windows, looking for lung detail. Here we're back in the soft tissue detail and going through again. I can stop anywhere. I go back to that little white thing. I can magnify. I can move it around. I can pan. I can measure things. What do you think that thing is? It's a white area. So what does white mean? It's really that white. It's really dense. And it's surrounded by dark. It's surrounded by fluid. It's a stone, but it's not a kidney. So the kidney's over here, and the spine is here, and these are muscles. And this is, let me just go back. Well, this is a little bit of the pancreas is right here, and this is the pancreatic duct, which is filled with fluid. This is the bile duct, and that's a kidney. That's a gallstone that has gone down into the duct and obstructed, and it's 4 millimeters. Wow. Here are some of those still images I mentioned. That wasn't her only problem, actually. She also has very thick-walled bowel. There, for instance, and here's the obstructed bile duct, and it's below this that the stone was present. Actually, there's the stone there with the kidneys. This is the left renal vein coming across to join the inferior vena cava where the vein drains into and then it goes up to the heart. This is the aorta where the blood goes down from the heart. We used IV contrast in her, so the aorta is enhanced and the kidneys are enhanced, et cetera. And here, lower down in her abdomen, she has more of this thick-walled bowel with enhancing mucosa, the inner lining of the bowel, with fluid centrally. But this is all abnormal. Any idea? And then she has some free fluid, just fluid that's not supposed to be there in her pelvis and elsewhere in her abdomen. So she has a lot of inflammation of something. Well, I've already told you what it is. She has inflammation of the bowel. So she has inflammatory bowel disease. It turns out she has Crohn's disease. So she has two reasons to have severe pain. And this was an active process. So she was had an active, very inflamed GI tract at the time of this exam, as well as having that stone. And then we can repackage it, as I mentioned, in another projection. So this is a coronal. And here's the bile duct. Here's the liver. This is the portal vein that brings blood into the liver. And this is the bile duct that's bigger than it should be. And it comes down into the head of the pancreas, and there's the stone. And there's her fluid, the abnormal fluid, and some of the abnormal bowel. And here's some more of her abnormal bowel. So we're looking in this projection now. This is not the way she was scanned. She was scanned like this. Okay, let's move into something else. I can hear some manipulation of just a chest x-ray. So we have all sorts of things. I can change the white and the black polarity. We can magnify that and look for more detail in the chest, looking at the ribs, looking at the lungs, going across to the other side, coming down. And then what do you think is going on? Well, actually, we can change the window settings, too. So I'm manipulating this so I get more detail behind the heart, more detail in the lungs, more detail for bones, etc. It's what we do for every single image. This patient has an abnormality, not in the chest, though. So the chest is actually normal. And this, I can't see the pointer at least. This is gas in the stomach. You have any idea what position this patient was in at the time of this x-ray? I mean, upright or lying down? Standing up. Because we have an air fluid level. So that's how I know. This is air, this is fluid, and this is an air fluid level. So the air rose up because the patient's upright. Well, something else rose up here. These are the diaphragms. So this separates the abdomen from the chest, and that shouldn't be there. So that's gas in the abdomen. Now, this patient had a reason for it. She had recent abdominal surgery. So, you know, there's always some gas in there after they've opened the abdomen. But if it wasn't that history, let's say it was possible bowel obstruction, that would mean the patient perforated and air was leaking out of the bowel. That is a medical emergency, if that was the history. It wasn't in this patient. Okay, so sometimes the signs that we look at are pretty obvious, and sometimes they're not. So let's go on and just talk about some of those obvious ones and some of those subtle ones. So here's just a normal chest x-ray. And, you know, it takes time to look at a normal chest x-ray. We're not just looking at the lungs. We are looking at the lungs all the way down to what's called the costophrenic angles, where they're sort of sulci, where the lowest part of the lungs might collect some fluid, like a pleural effusion. There's fluid around the lung that would gather maybe down there and blunt that angle. We look at the heart and the size, and we look for things that are hidden by the heart. Maybe I'm seeing a pneumonia back here. I'm not in this patient. We look at the mediastinum, where all the vessels go out of the heart and come back into the heart. Is that why it is, you know, are there abnormalities there? We're looking at every single rib and the vertebra and the clavicles. And if they're included, I'm looking at the shoulders. This one, you know, was screened, didn't get the shoulders, but I might see the shoulders. I'm looking at the abdomen below the, even though this is a chest x-ray. And this is the frontal view, and this is the lateral view. So the patient is looking, in this particular setting, looking to your left. And so we see the heart here, the diaphragm, the thoracic spine, and the lung. So what's going on here? This patient has a productive cough and a fever. Yeah, this is a pneumonia. And we know exactly where it is from subtle signs. Because the heart, here's the heart border nicely seen because it's outlined by the air next to it. This heart border is gone because it's outlined, it's obscured by the pneumonia sitting next to it. And on the lateral view, you can see this density is overlying the heart too. So it's in front of the patient as opposed to back here, like right here. So that, if it was back here, it would be in the right lower lobe of lung. But because it obscures the heart and is overlying the heart in a lateral view, it's in the right middle lobe. So that's how we, because the middle lobe lies adjacent to the heart, the lower lobe lies behind the heart and doesn't obscure its margin when we have a pneumonia in it or something else in there. So these are the subtle little things that we know. Any ideas what is going on here? This is the normal side. This is the abnormal side. And this one, you can see all these markings of vessels, etc. You don't see anything here but black. And the ribs behind it.
Collapsed lung?
It's a collapsed lung, and it's collapsed to here, and that is a big pneumothorax, as we call it. Air has leaked out into the pleural space, the space around the lung, and in this case, it's a tension pneumothorax. Here it is on a CT scan. This is all. There's nothing here. The collapsed lung is really dense here because it's collapsed, and this is all just air. This is a tension pneumothorax, meaning it's under pressure, and it's pushing the heart to the left. This is a medical emergency, too. This one is a small pneumothorax. That's more often what we see. That little line, which I can't really see my pointer very well, there's a little line next to that arrow, is the edge of the pleura, the edge of the lung, and the air is just beyond that. And that could be even smaller than that, and we can detect it on X-ray. There's another patient who has difficulty breathing. And I'll just take you through this. This patient's lungs are kind of expanded. His diaphragms are flattened. The markings in the lungs are disorganized. And here's a CT where on a coronal and an axial scan, you can see there are big areas of just dark. The vessels aren't well-defined. It's not as organized as a normal patient. And this patient has emphysema, you know, severe emphysema from smoking. Here's a patient with abdominal pain. We happen to get a chest X-ray. The chest is normal. Do you see anything on this exam, on this image? It's the exact same image. I've just changed the window settings to bring out dark areas to better, I mean, to white areas to better advantage. So it's the abnormality is down here in this white area, which you can't even see on the original image. And it's right here. Oh, no, sorry, it's down here. I can hardly see my own pointer. You know what that is? Here is the frontal view, and here's the lateral view. Those are gallstones sitting in the gallbladder. But if we don't look at that, we don't bring out the detail behind under the diaphragm, we would never know it was there on the original X-ray. And in the old days, before we could manipulate it, that's all we had. And that white area beneath the diaphragm, nothing we could have done. There's no way we would have seen those on the original, you know, in the old days before computerized, you know, digital imaging. Here's a patient with generalized discomfort and bloating. Chest X-ray. These are snaps, by the way. These are little snaps for EKG leads. So they're going to block X-rays. There's a lot of gas down here. That's not normal. Here's an abdominal X-ray, and this is very distended small bowel. Detected on the chest X-ray. But then when we go down to follow our hunch that this patient might have obstruction, we find obstruction, and the CT shows the same thing. Now, the X-ray is going to show the gas-filled loops of bowel. It's not going to show the fluid-filled loops of bowel, which these are. So here, are the gas-filled ones are dark. The fluid-filled ones are seen by CT and are, you know, are dark gray. Okay, sometimes we find things that we did not expect. Like here. Any idea what this white area is up here?
It's like a battery.
You could be a radiologist. That's exactly right. This patient swallowed a battery. No, it could have been in his pocket or something. Or
a double A.
I think it is a double A. You are entirely... It would be thinner if it was a triple A or... I mean... So that is a double A battery, and he swallowed it. And that's a medical problem because that battery can eventually erode and release the acid inside. And that's, you know, kind of catastrophic for the GI tract. So we would follow that and make sure it leaves the GI tract on its own. And if it doesn't, we got to take it out. Here's another one that's not the same sort of thing, but it's also an expected finding and an unexpected finding. The unexpected finding is even more important. So this patient had blood in the urine and left-sided pain. And here's the left kidney. And here's the normal right kidney. And it's got fat in it, et cetera. This one has a lot of fluid there. And then if we go down, we can see the fluid in the ureter, the tube that drains from the kidney to the bladder. Here we see the ureter. It's big. This is the tiny little normal size one on the other side. And then as we go down into the pelvis, you can see this very bright structure, the white structure, and some other white structures too. That one, and we have to know the anatomy. The other white structures are atherosclerotic plaque in this patient's vessels. So this patient has atherosclerosis, and they're calcified plaques. But that is a ureteral stone, a kidney stone that passed down and obstructed the ureter. But anybody see anything on the other side, the other kidney? Now, it's normal here. It's not normal on this one. Let me show you more. Then we gave IV contrast because we saw, we don't do that for a stone. We did it for what's going on this side that we didn't expect. And there's the kidney now enhanced with the IV contrast that we gave it, and it's excreting contrast. So these white areas now are the urine opacified by the IV contrast we gave, and it's going down down towards the bladder. But this, and this is the way the normal kidney would look. This is not the way the normal kidney would look. There's a mass there that turned out to be a carcinoma. That was totally unexpected. So that was more important finding than the stone we found. But not the cause of the pain. That's not why the patient came in. The patient came in with the left-sided pain from the stone. We often use imaging to determine just how extensive an abnormality is, like a tumor. This is an adrenal gland tumor, very extensive, unfortunately, that is involving... here it is. This is the pancreas. This is a little bit of the left kidney, and this is this big mass. And as we come down, the mass is even more extensive, wraps around the aorta, and goes on to the other side, and causes a little bit of obstruction in that left kidney. And here it is in the coronal view, where you can see it wrapping around the aorta. So this is bad news, but they treated the patient, and he comes back for a follow-up to see if it's getting worse or getting better. Unfortunately, now he's got obstruction on both sides. This is the obstructed left kidney with just a little thin rim of the kidney, and this is the urine in the obstructed part. And this is now the other side's obstructed as well, and the tumor has gotten bigger. Here's a patient with right lower abdominal pain, sort of the classic appearance of this particular entity. Here's the abnormality. Let me find my pointer. Here it is. On one axial image, obviously this is a series of axial images, and from that series of axial images, here's one coronal image. We have a series of those too, where the abnormality is this, and all the material around it. Anybody have a guess as to what that is? A common cause of right-sided pain. Right, that's an appendicitis. Here's a left-sided pain. Not the appendicitis. Well, actually, the appendix is variable. It can sometimes be on the left side. If the bowel is flopping around and it's a long appendix, it can actually cause pain on the left side, but that's unusual. This is not appendicitis. And the abnormalities, here's bowel, and this conglomeration of material is some gas that's not in the bowel and some inflammation, some edema, making this gray, disorganized-looking appearance. This is some bowel, and then some more inflammation. And then on the coronal image, here's the bladder, a little bit of muscle in the rectus abdominis muscle, gas in bowel and stomach and liver. And this is the abnormality down in the left lower quadrant. And then when we look at the sagittal image, which is the patient, as if the patient is looking to your left, there's the abnormality. And this turned out to be diverticulitis. So there's an inflamed diverticula with gas that leaked out. So it's a perforated diverticulitis. Also important to take care of that right away. If it hadn't perforated, they might wait, see how things do. But the fact that it's perforated, they're going to go in and operate. Okay, here's another case. Alcohol abuse. This happens to people sometimes when they drink too much. And here's a normal liver. Let me find my pointer. Liver here. Pancreas is here. Stomach with fluid and gas. Left kidney, we're a little bit above the right kidney. And this is the spleen. Let me find my pointer again. There's the spleen. So this is the normal thickness of the pancreas. This patient's liver is much darker than that normal liver. And the pancreas is this little tiny thing here. This is a vessel. This is the portal vein and the splenic vein. This is a little tiny pancreas. So as you know, People with alcohol abuse get liver disease, and they can get pancreatic atrophy. The atrophy, and eventually it can calcify, the pancreas can calcify. This patient doesn't have any tumor or other irreversible problems at this point, but maybe it's a wake-up call. This patient, this could look like cirrhosis from alcohol abuse, but this is cirrhosis from chronic hepatitis. And this liver, does it look like the other one I just showed you, the normal? Number one, it's not dark like the fatty liver. That was a fatty liver because it was had more fat, therefore it absorbed less X-ray and was dark. This one's not, it's a little dark, but it's very nodular. You can see all this little nodularity, and along the margins, it's very lobular because of nodules. It's also small. It's shrunk down. It has fluid around it. This is ascites. It has, this patient has a thick-walled stomach from inflammation and has varices. These are big vessels that can bleed. They can be in the esophagus. They can be around the stomach. They can be a number of other places in the abdomen from cirrhosis. And go down to the pancreas. The pancreas looks fine, but there's, you know, there's fluid around it. There's thick-walled stomach, fluid down here, and fluid down in the lower abdomen, et cetera. And the question is, does this patient have tumor? Because chronic hepatitis patients have a higher incidence of hepatic cellular carcinomas. It's hard to tell from this, but we're a little worried about this one big nodule. So we could either biopsy that or and or follow it and see if it gets bigger. So from this, I can't tell for sure it's cancer or not. It could just be a big benign nodule. But those are nodules that turn into cancers at some point. So we need follow-up of some sort in that patient. This is a liver mass. This is a series of CT, and it's called dynamic CT. We inject the contrast in a vein, and we scan over time. So we might scan initially during what we call the arterial phase, when the aorta and the other vessels are really bright, and it causes some enhancement of the mass here, but most of the mass is dark. Maybe 10 seconds, 30 seconds later, we scan again. And now you can see the aorta is not as dense. The contrast is washing out. Now the veins are beginning, this is the portal vein in the liver, those are beginning to enhance, and we have more enhancement of the tumor. And then we scan about 5 minutes out, and the tumor, the mass, has completely enhanced. And the same on MR. Here's a mass in the liver without the contrast. We inject the contrast. We do a dynamic liver MR, and you can see the enhancement around the periphery, and that eventually fills it in. That's very characteristic of a benign type of mass, a hemangioma. There's no way we would not biopsy that because they're vascular, number one. Number two, we know it's benign just from the way it looks. This one isn't so good a story, though. Here's the mass. You can barely see it before we gave any IV contrast. Here it is with these little squiggly vessels in it after we gave the IV contrast. Those are abnormal arteries within the tumor, unlike that other patient I just showed you. And then eventually, over time, it has this disorganized, enhanced look. And this turns out was a liver cancer. And that patient, then the question is, okay, we've made a diagnosis, and if we need to, we can biopsy it. But is this patient somebody who should go to surgery? If we can't cure the patient and we can't help them, why put them through that? So on that same CT scan, now we're looking at a coronal image. You can see all the bowel down here, the bladder, et cetera, the liver here. Here's the mass right here. Here's the portal vein, which brings blood back into the liver. And unfortunately, it has tumor in it. That's an inoperable tumor. So they could take this out, but they can't take that out. So there's no point in subjecting that patient to a surgery. I have so many things. I could show you thousands of images. If you want to stay about, you know, a month, we can go through a small segment of what, you know, we could look at. And it does take 4 years of residency after medical school, and then most radiology residents stay on for a year or two of subspecialty fellowship. I added a year of research in that. So, you know, it takes a while to be, and we're constantly learning, too. We never stop learning. So and I can't show you everything, but here's one. Trauma patient has, on an x-ray, a compression of a vertebra, and you could see on the CT, you know, that it's not all, it's a compression, but it's not encompassing, it's not stenosing the vertebral canal, as it's called, where the spinal cord is and the nerve roots run. So this we could let heal on its own. This patient, however, wasn't so lucky. Here's one of the many images we have through the spine, where you can see the fractured vertebra, and there's bone that got pushed back into the vertebral canal. And here it is on a sagittal image going this way, where you can see the bone is creating a narrowing or stenosis of the canal. And here it is on MR. Here's the bone. Here are the nerve roots all compressed. And just a little bit below the fracture, here's the way it should look, with fluid and the nerve roots. And here it's all compressed. All the nerve roots are compressed. And on the sagittal images, what we call T1 and what we call T2, where the T2 brings out, makes a fluid white, you could see that stenosis. It's a lot of information. A little bit about ultrasound. I'm going to spend not as much time on some of the other modalities, just because we don't have the time. But I'd love to, because I was involved in a lot of the early research with ultrasound, too. And it came out of World War II, you know, out of sonar. And eventually was made into a medical imaging device. And then it came out in 1979, where were real-time scanners, where we can hold it in place and see motion, like a baby moving around, or we can make motion and look around the patient's anatomy. We can add Doppler, look at vascular blood flow. And then color Doppler was added, so we can actually code the flow with colors to see how fast the blood cells are going, et cetera, and use 3D and 4D, 4D being motion and 3D imaging. You know, you're used to thinking about it for obstetrical ultrasound, and it's very useful for looking for abnormalities or just dating the pregnancy. How big is this is a fairly early pregnancy, but the fetus is a certain size, and we can figure out how far along the pregnancy is from that. And maybe we follow the patient later, and it hasn't grown the appropriate amount. We can say there's some growth retardation. That's not brain retardation, that's growth retardation, and et cetera. So it's very useful in that regard. We can look for abnormalities of the placenta, the fluid, the baby itself, et cetera. There are also several intracavitary probes that get our ultrasound probes closer to the area of interest, whether it be in the rectum or the vagina or down the esophagus, et cetera. And it's very good for distinguishing cystic masses from solid masses, et cetera. Here's an unfortunate case with ultrasound. The ultrasound on this side, here's the head, and the posterior fossa, the back of the head where the cerebellum is, the posterior aspect of the brain, is very small in this baby, in this fetus. And here's the placenta, here's the amniotic fluid, et cetera. And here on a sagittal image through the spine, the lower spine, the sacrum and lower lumbar spine. So here's lumbar spine, creating these shadows from the bone. Here's the sacrum, and there's an outpouching of fluid there. And we can also do MR in obstetrical patients. So here's the baby's head. The front of the head is here in this particular case, and these are ventricles, the fluid-filled areas inside the head, which are distended in this fetus. Here is the pelvis, where that outpouching is, and here's a sagittal view with the head up here, and the outpouching is down here, and that's through a defect in the sacrum itself called the spina bifida, and a meningomyelocele, which is the sac of fluid coming out of the spine, sometimes with nerves in it, is what this is and what that is. All detected while the fetus is still in the mother. Of course, do 3D of babies. It has some usefulness, I think more for marketing than anything, but it does have some usefulness. We don't do very much of it, but I've seen, you know, advertisements for, you know, come and get, you know, Valentine's Day special, two people can come in and get images of your baby and for your album. That's not a very good use of ultrasound. Here's just, you know, Doppler imaging, looking at vessels, color coding it for the speed of the blood vessels, et cetera. looking for narrowing, looking for abnormal vessels. MR, very powerful tool, different than CT. Also a volume of data, so we can manipulate it because we have a volume of data, but it's collected in a totally different way. It doesn't use radiation. It really makes use of the fact that if we're scanning, if we're looking at certain nuclei, like a proton, a hydrogen nucleus has one spinning electron. Anything that has an odd number, has a spinning, you know, odd number of electrons, is a bar magnet. It creates a magnetic field. So every little proton is a bar magnet, and when we bombard it with a radio frequency that's specific for that strength of the magnet and that proton, we can flip them. And then when we turn off the radio frequency, they come back to their resting state and they're wobbling, and they give off a signal. And it's that signal that we detect with antennas that are built into the scanner. And then we can impart with various complex methods, we can figure out where the signal was coming from all through the patient's body and all sorts of other information. And we can manipulate how we gather the data by changing the radio frequency, changing how long we wait to listen for that signal that's coming back, all sorts of things, all done without any moving parts and without any radiation. But they have to go into a tube. Some people are claustrophobic. It takes a lot longer than a CT scan. We can now do a CT scan. I can do 1,000 images in about 9 seconds. Whereas when I first started doing this, we had the fastest. When I worked with the Varian Corporation when I was at Stanford, we could we had the fastest by far scanner in the world. 6 seconds per image. Everybody else was like 35 seconds. In 6 seconds, I can do 500 images now, and they're thinner. And that gives me much better data for 3D, et cetera. And the patient doesn't move. You know, they can hold their breath through the entire scan, as opposed to maybe 3 images, breathe, some more images. So by the time they got through breathing, the organs are in different places. Much, much better. Well, MR, a little slower, but we have ways to do that really fast now, too, as that's developed. So technology has changed radiology dramatically. And so it's given us better detective tools over the years. And we can even do spectroscopy where we can look at the tissue signatures within the living tissue, looking for evidence of cancer or changes over time, et cetera, from growth or successfully treated cancers, et cetera. Here's just one example of an MR in a patient with a brain tumor. This is the tumor. This is the tumor, and this is edema fluid leaking out into the tissues of the brain, and you could see the compression of the ventricles. These are those fluid-filled ventricles we talked about in the ultrasound, dark on a T1 on this image and bright on this image, and you could see the compression, the mass effect of that tumor, and a lot more information can come from that. Nuclear medicine, lots of exams, lots of radionuclides that can be injected that accumulate in various things like bone, or liver, or thyroid. You know, radioactive iodine would go to the thyroid. Technetium goes to bone and to liver. And the newest and most powerful, really, is the PET scan, the positron emission tomography. And it goes to areas where there's a lot of metabolism. It's really a sugar-based radioactive material that goes where there's metabolism, but it doesn't have great spatial resolution. So we would do a CT, and then a few days later, you do a PET scan, and you try to guess where the abnormality is on a PET scan relative to the anatomy seen on CT. Well, now they're all in one system. So while the patient's on the table, they get a PET scan and a CT scan. I know exactly where everything is anatomically. That's called PET CT. And it's good for all these things. I mean, it's good for a lot of things. We can detect more foci of abnormality than we might even notice on a CT scan. Because some little area of abnormal uptake is visualized. You may not know what organ it's in from that, but what you do when you do you correlate it with the CT scan. And here's what that looks like. So here's a patient with a breast cancer with a lung metastasis on the right side and a metastasis to an axillary lymph node. But where is that on the PET scan? You know, it's hard to see even what anatomy that is. Here's the CT scan of the mass and of the lymph nodes, and you can fuse them together. See exactly where things are. And then I'm going to finish up with interventional radiology. It's a diagnostic tool. It's a way that we can also be detectives in giving a more accurate diagnosis. And we can also then take it a step further and treat the patient without having to have them opened up. We can use catheters and probes and needles and all sorts of things have been invented over the years, over the last 20 years, for interventional radiology, where we do a biopsy or we can stick a needle in aspirate fluid to determine whether something's infected or not, for instance, or we can actually treat it, put a catheter in and drain the fluid, or fluid in the around the lung called an effusion. When we had that pneumothorax and we had air around the lung, if you have fluid around the lung, that's called an effusion. Or the ascites. We might have a lot of ascites in a patient's abdomen, and you want to just take it off for therapeutic reasons. You can stick a needle in there and drain it. They can open obstructed bile ducts and obstructed vessels. They can bypass ducts. They can stent a vessel. They can balloon a vessel to open it and keep it open. And they can put in various things to treat an active bleed. So they can embolize that patient and cause it to clot, and that area, that vessel rather, to cause it to clot and stop the bleeding. Or they might embolize a tumor to kill off the blood supply to the tumor and hopefully kill off the tumor. They can, well, let me just show you. So here is a patient. Question is whether that was a metastasis from a known kidney cancer or is a new lung cancer. We can stick a needle in it right under CT guidance without opening the patient and avoid, we can pick the path based on the imaging. So we avoid things we don't want to hit with the needle and get right into it and also prove that the tissue came from the mass. So the pathologist says, I don't see any tumor, but I'm not sure you actually got it. Well, we can see that this the needle's in the tumor. So it's has those kind of useful aspects. Here's a patient with a really severe pancreatitis who developed not just this one, but other fluid collections. So this might be a pancreatic pseudocyst, which is sterile, but it's still a bad thing, or it might be infected. We can stick a needle in it, aspirate it, see if it's infected, and also then draw it off, even if it's not infected, to have the patient get better sooner. And then a new thing, a fairly new thing, is called interventional oncology, where the same radiologists, interventional radiologists, use some of their tools to treat tumors. So we might biopsy for diagnosis, but now we're biopsying even known tumors so that we can get their genetic signature and develop personalized medicine, personalized treatments for that particular tumor with that genetic code. Or we might just, as I mentioned, treat it. Tumor ablation is where we stick something in a tumor to kill it off. It might be a probe, and we might freeze it. We might heat it up with radio frequency. We might put a catheter in a vessel leading up to that tumor and inject something that will kill it off, like alcohol or a radioactive substance. Or we might just try to change the configuration of the tumor and shrink it down before the patient goes to surgery, to make it more manageable. Or if the patient's going to have part of their liver taken out, we might try to decrease the size of that lobe of the liver so the other lobe gets bigger and can support them, you know, can support their life after they take away some of the liver. So those are some of the things that, and that's what this is. So they're putting in coils into the liver in an attempt to shrink one part by cutting off its blood supply, because that's the part that's going to be taken away, and then let the other part regenerate and get bigger. So that was a lot of stuff, I hope it's not too fast. Thank you. And we still have some time for questions.
When someone goes to Stanford or John Muir or Sutter and they get a CT done and they take it to UCSF, are we now at the point where everybody can read everybody's information, no matter where you have it generated from?
I don't know about everywhere because, you know, I think many parts of the world are still using film. And they're still hanging their film on, you know, to dry. Or maybe they have a machine to go through the chemicals.
But here in the Bay Area.
Absolutely.
Okay.
So I've done this, you know, and I brought things from John Muir on a family member to UCSF. I we can take that CD, we can load it into our own system, and I can see it on that workstation that I was showing you, and so can everybody else in our department, no matter whether they're at Mission Bay, they're at Mount Zion on Divisadero, they're here, and we would put it up. On one screen, we'd have, well, if we're doing a new study on that patient, we'll have the John Muir study next to it, and we'll compare them as if we did it. Now, it might look a little different because they designed different protocols or whatever, or their scanner just looks a little different, but it's all readable and today. Now, this wasn't the case 10 years ago. And as you know, you can take a CD. I can transmit the image over broadband anywhere in the world. And somebody in Australia can look at the image from here. We can send it to the home. So a radiologist on call. I used to drive into the hospital 7 times a night to look at an image and then drive home. And I'd get an hour of sleep or whatever I got, and I'd drive in again, and I'd drive home. And I did a lot of research on some of the early PACs, that picture archival communication system. I was, that was also an academic interest of mine. I was a consultant to multiple companies on developing those systems that are now, become absolutely essential. But in those days, you'd have to drive in for everything. And then I had the access to a system that could do this sort of thing. It was sort of jerry-rigged that I put together from some of the equipment that from a couple of the companies I was consulting with. And I put it into the hospital and convinced I had it at my home. And this is before broadband, before rapid speeds of transmission. So I would put 4 phone lines together I had a rack of equipment that would take, a phone line only can transmit about 16 kilobits per second. Very small amounts of data. And so 4 phone lines I had in my bedroom with this rack of equipment to make 56 kilobits per second, which is, nothing. A chest x-ray has so much data. And so does the CT, of course, with all those images. And I would have them transmit to me at home back in the early days before there ever was teleradiology. Now we can do that. And I finally convinced my partners, this is going to change your life if we get something like this. They said, no, we don't want that. It's computers, and we don't want that. And it changed their lives. Because I could look at 7 exams in a night and not have to leave my house.
Well, my question is, of all the things you've talked about tonight, or maybe have not talked about, you have now find the most awesome.
That I think is the most awesome?
Yes.
Ooh.
That blows your mind.
Well, I'm still, and I've had lots of research things I've been involved in, like the early days of CT. I was telling Jeff Tabus before we started this talk about when I did work with the Varian Corporation in the Silicon Valley when I was at Stanford. And I would bring patients in my car from Stanford Hospital to the factory and dogs and figure out what, how to do CT. Because there were no scanners. It was only that one head scanner. Couldn't do bodies. So that was unbelievable pioneering times. And then when MR came along, got involved in that, got involved in this teleradiology and ultrasound. But I would still say the thing that turns me on the most today is the 3D, is the ability to take the data that we already have and just make unbelievable high-resolution, lifelike movies and images and move through. So the teaching of medical students, for instance, is fantastic with that technique. That's just using computer graphics and computer power as it's evolved to make better use of what we already have than we ever could before. For me personally, that's what I love doing right at the moment. I still love doing CT scans, and I love being a detective. And I left orthopedic surgery to go to radiology for 2 reasons. It was the technology that had been invented by Hounsfield, and CT had just come out, and it was computer-based, and I thought, whoa, this is going to change the world, which, of course, it ended up doing. And it was that detective work, and I still love that. Teasing out. Maybe I'll observe something that somebody else doesn't observe, and I'm looking for little details, and I'm teasing out the clues, and trying to put it all together. That still excites me.
Who creates these programs that goes to, you know, that change the CT scans to the 3D modules, and then do they send trainers out to teach you how to do it?
They do. Well, nobody trained me in that. I mean, I sort of just figured it out. You do. I mean, and well, like the 3D for the, you know, the graphic, the computer graphic manipulation. There are a number of companies that make software for that. I happen to be a medical consultant to one that doesn't actually sell it to anybody. They license it to other companies like GE or somebody like that, and they use that. But I'm a consultant to them and help them develop that and figure out applications for it, as well as what looks good, what doesn't look good, you know, what might be a better technique. But the companies that actually make it and they sell it, and we have multiple different companies, different vendors here, and their software and hardware. You bring up a really important point. They're all different. They can all do about the same things. You know, some do it a little bit better in one way, or have more tools, more computer-based tools. But because their user interfaces are different and they're complex, it's very hard to train like a technologist to figure out how to use it. And they get used to using one, and there might be another one that comes along that's even more powerful. But they don't want to use it because they don't understand it. They understand the one they're used to. Is that what you're talking about? So, and for those companies, there are people that come around. They have applications people. That means applications are training people. You know, they train people. So they're hired by, they're trained by their company to go out and train other people, users. Everything we do, a new CT scanner, they bring trainers. I just trained yesterday. The computer system that I showed you with the workstation, we're getting a brand new one Monday. It goes operational Monday. And I just had my training session yesterday. Now, I was off the wall excited by all these new tools. I'm telling you, I talked to my colleagues. They are scared. They don't want to do it. You know, they don't want to learn something new. You know, I'm a person that embraces change, and I love, you know, learning new things and exploring through my computer or exploring through this new system that I learned about yesterday that's going live on Monday. But there were trainers there. I only had an hour, you know, with that trainer because somebody else is scheduled for the next hour. But it was great. I mean, I was just so excited after that session because there are a lot of new things it'll do, a lot of new tools that I didn't show you because I don't have access to them yet. I'll have access to them on Monday. Okay. Thank you very much. I enjoyed it. Hope you did.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.